The term the Roaring Twenties conjures up visions of decadent parties, jazz bands, and lots of champagne. Filmmakers and writers like F. Scott Fitzgerald helped shape this classic American image. In her latest book, Careless People, Murder, Mayhem, and the Invention of the Great Gatsby, Sarah Churchwell explores how the celebrities, current events, and crimes of the 1920s influenced Fitzgerald and his work. And she is a professor of American literature at the University of East Anglia. Her book is published by the Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased to welcome Sarah Churchwell to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
Fitzgerald and his wife Zelda were known for their wit, good looks, and ability to entertain, and they also spent quite a lot of time at parties. How much of their behavior was for the benefit of their public image? Were they early caught up in that whole celebrity sensibility?
Absolutely. There are many people who think that a lot of their famous antics were precisely to generate publicity, that they were very self-consciously staged. I think the truth is somewhere in between. I think they were young, they were having a lot of fun, and they were show-offs, you know? So whether you think that being a show-off is you know, the question is whether you're an innocent show-off or a cynical show-off. And I tend to think they were fairly innocent show-offs. But it then eventually, it was generating its own publicity, became a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy.
But they were also provocative at times. The Fitzgeralds would make taunt others to amuse themselves. So there was a little bit of cruelty in all of this?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it's easy to, or, you know, a little bit of, I don't know if I'd go so far as cruelty, but I think it's important to remember how young they were when these famous stories were happening. In the year that I set most of my book is 1922, which is also the year that Fitzgerald sets The Great Gatsby. And at that point, Zelda was 22, Scott was 26. They were you know, the equivalent of kids just out of college. And so, yeah, they could do, you know, they could do kind of stupid frat boy esque, you know, stunts and, you know, tease people and things. I'm not sure I'd call it cruel so much as it was thoughtless. And it was, again, I think they liked to be the center of attention, and they were certainly capable of putting other people down. Yeah.
How much of that is reflected in his writings?
I think it's reflected in his writings so much insofar as he is always interested in power hierarchies, and he's particularly interested in social hierarchies. Obviously, The Great Gatsby is one of our preeminent novels about class in the 20th century. But it's not always – he's not overtly necessarily always interested in the economics of class, although that comes into it, but also in the niceties of you know, jockeying for position and status.
I remember that The Great Gatsby was very popular in the UK. You teach in England. Is it because it's about class? Is it more popular than Moby Dick, let's say?
Well, it's definitely more popular than Moby Dick.
No, but I mean, than any of a number of other great American novels, because it is something that resonates in the British mind as well?
Well, it's interesting, you know, because I end up teaching it to British students, pointing out to them that it has a class system that they ought to recognize. They've been taught that America doesn't have a class system. They've kind of accepted, I know, they've accepted America's publicity on
that
one.
They don't know about the 1% and
exactly.
The 99%?
Exactly. We try to point this out to them. And so, you know, what I say to them is the class system that Fitzgerald is depicting in Gatsby should look awfully familiar to anybody who's British, because it still operates that way in Britain. So I think it is a point of connection, but they have a misunderstanding at the outset that needs to be corrected.
But it's also about climbing, that's something that the British were quite aware of only more recently, I guess in the 19th century, when they started using terms like nouveau riche.
And parvenu. I mean, Fitzgerald, in his letters to his editor, describes Gatsby as a parvenu. He thinks of him as a parvenu. And so Fitzgerald's own class position is a little bit complicated and ambivalent. He's middle class, but he's educated at Princeton with patrician people. And so he has, certainly towards art, he has very patrician attitudes, but also towards certain kinds of social niceties. He doesn't approve of vulgarity, although he was capable of vulgarity himself.
Were they aware of the fact that the world was changing at that time? I mean, you have, at one point in your book, you share a letter in which Fitzgerald conjugated the noun cocktail as if it were a verb. As I cocktail, I have cocktailed.
Yes, we might have had to have cocktailed. I like the imperative cocktail exclamation mark. They were very aware of it. And it was something that increasingly became part of the conversation. I quote from Virginia Woolf at one point in her 1925 essay, American Fiction, which, of course, is the same year that The Great Gatsby is published. She says, the Americans are coining new words. And when a country, she says, they were doing it like the Elizabethans did. And when a country is coining new words, you realize that a new literature is going to come out of it. So it wasn't just the Americans who knew they were doing it. The British were starting to take notice as well.
And what were some of the words? Guy and fellow?
I had a lot of fun chasing these up. The language of merchant banking emerged at this time, so the phrase merchant bank itself, but also inflationary, deflationary, arbitrage, which I thought was a word from the 80s, subprime, our old friend, but words that we really associate with, or at least I associated with much more recent slang and ideas. Post-feminist is 1919. Transvestite.
Post-feminist already?
Post-feminist is 1919. Now, they're using it slightly differently, but not that differently. And celebrity stalker, the OED gives the earliest known use of that from the 1980s, but I found one in 1923. The language of mass media emerges because the British Broadcasting Corporation, the beloved BBC, is founded at the end of 1922. And the words broadcast, broadcaster, mass media, mass market, all of that language emerges at the same time, too.
And a phrase like to pan a show.
Yeah, absolutely. And to party. E. Cummings uses party as a verb for the first time at the end of 1922. Scott Fitzgerald is credited with being the first to use wicked as a term of approval. Hmm. So if you say, we partied last night and it was wicked, I would have thought that was completely 90s slang. But my research revealed to me that, in fact, you could have said that in the 20s.
How did Fitzgerald use his own experiences in New York society to write about how someone like Gatsby would remake himself?
One of the things that interested me in the research I did into newspapers and magazines and into the real-life events of 1922 was how uncannily the facts and the stories around Fitzgerald seemed to pick up on the key themes of the novel. And it was remarkable how many people in the early 1920s were actually inventing aristocratic romantic paths for themselves and changing their names. And I found a couple of representative examples of that, but there were many others.
Well, earlier we had American heiresses going to Britain to marry British nobility.
It's all very Downton Abbey, isn't it?
and now they were just doing it themselves here in the United States?
Well, just inventing it, right? Just create a spurious title for yourself. And that you know that's what he's that's what Fitzgerald is tracing, is this explosion of wealth and the way that it seems to shift class structures, but in many ways actually doesn't.
Well, how is that reflected in Fitzgerald's own arc?
Well, I mean, Fitzgerald was himself, I think, very. Some people have accused him of hypocrisy, and I think that's an ungenerous and if I may say so, slightly narrow-minded way of looking at it. I think, for me, a much more accurate way of talking about it is to say that he was ambivalent. And I think Gatsby reflects that ambivalence. He loved wealth. He liked really big parties. He thought they were great. He was an artist, and so he liked the gorgeous things of life. He wanted everything to be beautiful around him, and he wanted it all to be, you know, he had this appetite for the gorgeous, but the gorgeous is expensive. But he also was smart enough to recognize the hollowness and toxicity of chasing wealth.
Well, doesn't that also apply to his marriage? He loved the gorgeous. Zelda is gorgeous, but she's also a real problem.
She became difficult, it is true.
Was she already showing signs of her bipolar illness?
Some people think so. I mean, she was diagnosed as schizophrenic at the time. Now people tend to think she was probably bipolar. But you can't really diagnose somebody who's been long dead. And so that's going to be, hypothetical.
But she wound up in a mental institution.
She certainly had a breakdown. She certainly had a very serious breakdown. And she was in and out of mental institutions for the last 18 years of her life. And other people have said, Fitzgerald just locked away an inconvenient wife as if he were, Mr. Rochester, which is completely unfair. It's unfair to the severity of her illness, which was very real and very frightening for both of them. But also it's unfair to his loyalty and to the profoundness of his love for her. So, yes, yes, she became difficult, quote unquote, but he was no picnic himself. I mean, his drinking problems spiraled out of control as her mental health problems worsened, and so they were they had a wonderful golden period and a lot of fun, and then it all started to fall apart.
And they both had affairs.
That's actually quite questionable. The Zelda had an emotional attachment to an aviator the summer that Fitzgerald was writing The Great Gatsby. How far that affair went, nobody really knows. She cared about him. But the
she
thing,
was an outrageous flirt.
She was definitely an outrageous flirt. But when you actually look at their letters, you see in the later years, you see so Zelda accused Scott of having an affair with Tallulah Bankhead's sister, and he writes her a personal letter saying, you know, he's basically just outraged, and he says, "You accuse me of being with her, and I would never have. I mean, I don't even know what you're talking about." That kind of thing, which makes me think that the stories about infidelity could also have been exaggerated and part of that self-mythologizing. Zelda later said after Scott's death, she said that she wished she hadn't taunted him so much. She let him think that she was cheating on him, but she might not have been.
My guest is Sarah Churchwell, professor of American Literature and Public Understanding of the Humanities at the University of East Anglia. Her latest book, Careless People, Murder, Mayhem, and the Invention of the Great Gatsby. I want to get to that murder and mayhem in a little while, but since you mentioned Tallulah Bankhead's sister, they did socialize with some pretty famous people of the time, Gloria Swanson and Douglas Fairbanks, movie stars, Cole Porter, Pablo Picasso. How much did Fitzgerald draw inspiration for his characters from those people who were around him?
He always drew inspiration from real-life people, and he was very open about it. And, you know, he would cheerfully write letters saying things like that Jordan Baker in Gatsby is based on a golfer called Edith Cummings. And you know, he was never trying to disguise that. In fact, he and Hemingway had a dispute about this after Fitzgerald published Tender as the Night, because Hemingway told him that it was an illegitimate mode of composition to base your characters on other people, which is a bit rich coming from Hemingway, because he tended to do it too.
And in Romana Clay is a long tradition
exactly.
in literature.
But in fact, Fitzgerald doesn't write Romana Clays because the stories are always his. The Sun Also Rises is a Romana Clay where Hemingway tells what really happened in Spain. With Fitzgerald, the story is always imagined, but the characters are based on people that he knew, and then he reinvents them. And he often, most of the time, uses himself and Zelda and puts them in, you know, melds them with these other people. But so virtually every character in his fiction you could trace back to a person that he knew, maybe it's an overstatement to say everyone, but much of his, you know, The Rich Boy, which is one of his most famous stories, is based on his friend Ludlow Fowler. The first story he wrote after Gatsby called, I think it's called A Love Story or The Love Boat, actually, believe it or not, is based on a Russian prince that they met. I mean, that was his mode. That was how he did it. But the stories, the plots are completely Fitzgerald. So he takes these characters and then puts them into an imaginary world.
And often puts them into parties.
He certainly does.
Would things have been different if there hadn't been prohibition?
Oh, yeah. Prohibition changed everything. I think that, you know, prohibition changed America's attitudes to drinking profoundly. It backfired so spectacularly and so quickly. It is a pure example of the laws of unintended consequences, because it did exactly the opposite of what they wanted it to do. It made drinking respectable for the first time.
And Gatsby makes money from bootlegging.
Yeah. It's one of the ways he makes money. I mean, Fitzgerald
I didn't say it was the only way.
Absolutely. He's got his fingers in lots of different pies. And Fitzgerald is very careful to associate Gatsby with much of the criminal activity of the famously corrupt 1920s.
Throughout the book, you alternate sections about Fitzgerald's life with ones about his fiction, 1920s America, and the Halls Mills murders. Now, tell us about the Halls Mills murders and how they play a role in the Great Gatsby.
Yeah. The Hall Mills murders, it was a double homicide in September 1922. Two bodies were found in a field outside of New Brunswick, New Jersey, and it was a minister and a woman who sang in his choir, and they had been having an affair. They were married to other people, and they'd been having an affair for at least 3 years that was becoming increasingly blatant, and they were found murdered in a field with their love letters scattered around them and his calling card propped against his foot to assist the authorities in identifying the bodies. It turns out the authorities needed all the help they could get, and it became an incredibly incompetent investigation, so incompetent that people began to whisper that it was corrupt. And what I found as I was following the story, it was front page news through the end of 1922. The Fitzgeralds definitely followed it. Everybody followed it. It was as famous as Leopold and Loeb and the other big crimes.
Well, it's a juicy thing when a reverend is having an affair with one of his parishioners.
Absolutely. absolutely. I mean, I made a little joke in my book that you know, he was a rector who lost his rectitude. So it, of course, it was juicy, and the scandals only compounded by the fact that the authorities couldn't figure out what was going on. So the bodies had to be exhumed. It turned out that the original policeman at the scene had missed two of the three bullet holes in the woman's face. They'd missed the fact that her throat was slit from ear to ear. So they just weren't paying very close attention, you know. And so I shouldn't laugh. I mean, it's a terrible, gruesome story, but it also does become a kind of black farce as it unfolds.
And it inspired the killings in the Great Gatsby?
I think that it, not literally, but I think what it really inspired, as I say, Fitzgerald's mode was to base his characters on people and not his plots. The plot of the Great Gatsby is different from what happens in the Hall Mills murder, but the female victim, Eleanor Mills, is a dead ringer for Myrtle Wilson. She's accused of being pushy and officious. They say that she's having an affair with a man of a higher status in order to get the finer things in life. She lives in this dingy one-room apartment with a husband who is described in the newspapers at the time in language that's almost verbatim the way that Fitzgerald describes George Wilson. So I think, once again, he's getting his characters are inspired by this story, and then he makes the plot serve his own purposes.
The Great Gatsby is often described as something close to a perfectly written book. He never did that again because of the alcohol?
No, not entirely because of the alcohol. What happened was that when Gatsby came out, he knew what he'd done. He wrote letters to people saying, I've written a magnificent novel, and I really want to know what people think of it. And critically, it was very, very disappointing to him. There were only a handful of very, percipient readers, who, including T.S. Eliot, who worked out what he'd done. But for the most part, the readers were dismissive, including some of the most influential critics in America. And so,
well, on the other hand, a movie was made of it fairly soon.
Yeah, but his stuff was always turned into movies, but he was seen as a popular writer, and this was his bid for literary greatness, and nobody was taking it seriously. They were dismissing it as a trivial work. So it had a certain kind of popularity, but that wasn't what he was after. And what happened then was that I think he started to second guess himself. He had thought it was a wonderful book, and then when nobody else did, he tried to do something different with Tender as the Night. And then the alcoholism got in the way as well, and then that became a kind of, you know, it was a vicious circle.
So then the books get a little sloppier.
I don't think I would go that far. It just takes him longer to do it. I don't think Tender as the Night is a sloppy book. I think it's a magnificent book in many, many ways, but it took him 9 years to write it.
And then The Last Tycoon?
And then The Last Tycoon. Well, that's, to me, the interesting one. I mean, not that I don't love Tender, but that what happens is then after Tender, when that also, he tries to do something different to make the critics happy. The critics still aren't happy. They're never going to be satisfied. And he realizes that. And after Tender, he decides to go back to the mode of Gatsby. And he writes letters saying, in The Last Tycoon, I want to do something like Gatsby again. And he saw that as, he said, his true line with Gatsby. He should have stuck with that.
We have about 30 seconds to go, but do you see the 20s of Gatsby still with us?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the subtexts of my book, is how much of modern America is happening in the world around Gatsby. There are echoes everywhere of our world, and all the lessons that they learned, we forgot and have had to learn all over again.
Because right now we're going through a similar period?
Extremely similar. I mean, the first Ponzi, Charles Ponzi, is 1920 to 1922, and I was reading articles from 1922 talking about how America could never forget the Ponzi lesson.
Then we have Bernie
Madoff.
And
I'm reading these as Bernie Madoff is being indicted. And there are all kinds of examples like that.
Sarah Churchwell is a professor of American literature and public understanding of the humanities at the University of East Anglia. Her latest book, Careless People, Murder, Mayhem, and the Invention of the Great Gatsby, published by the Penguin Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you very much for having me.